Pushkin.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handled them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Writing is the best way that I can communicate. And I think I learned that really early on, that social interactions, like I would come away from it feeling like, I didn't exactly articulate myself in the way that I wanted to, or I could see that there was a misunderstanding, or I just really didn't feel like I had verbal language that would fit the playground to describe, you know, like what I'm thinking and how I'm seeing the world. So I've always needed to process thoughts in that way.
That was Morgan Parker. I'm Sam Fragoso, and this is Talk Easy. Welcome to the show. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. We have been off for about 2 months now. January and a little bit of February is the only time this podcast takes a break. Despite everyone's wishes on the show to take more breaks, we do about 45 of these a year every Sunday morning. If you have not listened to the show before, welcome. If you have been listening, welcome back. 2020 is going to be a big year, and we're going to do our best to keep up with it. Apparently, in the past 2 months, some big things have happened. In my notes, I have a few things written down, including our president, who has not been impeached. Bong Joon-ho won Best Director, and Parasite won Best Picture. Are those things equally important to Trump's lack of impeachment? I think so. RuPaul hosted SNL. That was big. Kobe Bryant passed away. Maybe the second best player of all time. That was horrendous and heartbreaking. Other things happened too, but those are the big highlights in case you somehow missed them. Oh, there's a coronavirus. I think they changed the name as of 2 days ago. I don't know the new name. I should. I don't. But what's most important is that you're here right now, and I want to thank you for being here. I also want to say, I'm glad to start off the show in 2020 with Morgan Parker. She is a poet, a novelist, an essayist. She is, above all, a fantastic writer. If you are like me, you are not a poetry scholar. You are not a literary critic. I enjoy a Walt Whitman, a Langston Hughes, a Sylvia Plath, like any sensible person. But I don't know a whole much about poetry. I never got into Emily Dickinson. I do feel some residual Catholic guilt about that, but not that much guilt, if I'm honest. I have read a fair bit of Morgan's work. There are two poetry collections from Parker I especially love. One is called There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé, obviously a genius title. The second, which came out last year through Tin House, is called Magical Negro. If you have not read Morgan's work, you can do so at morganparker.com. You can also buy either of those books wherever you get books. She is a fantastic writer, and I think what I most responded to is the way she couches drama and comedy. There is this kind of deep trauma and sadness within her work, especially in Magical Negro, but it's expressed with a real sense of humor. Her writing, at least for me, really did upset me and trouble me and stay with me. And then it made me laugh again and again. And then suddenly you're in this strange situation where you have to reconcile the pain with the jokes. And I hoped this conversation would resemble that juxtaposition, but you will have to be the judge of that. Before we get into it, in listening back on the edit of this episode, I noticed a difference in the way I was asking questions. Something felt off. I wasn't sure if I was rusty or out of practice, and then I figured it out. For the past 2 months, my only source of podcasting has come every morning in the shower, listening to Michael Barbaro on The Daily. If you have not heard of the show, I would urge you to seek it out. If you have heard of it, you know what I'm talking about. He has this kind of word-by-word rhythm that I find at once bizarre and oddly charming. It goes something like this, and again, I'm not great at impressions, but it sounds something like this. From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, poet Morgan Parker on the changing landscape of contemporary poetry, and why mass audiences that are predominantly white must reevaluate how they approach work made by people that do not look like them. It's Sunday, February 16th. That's my impression. Don't ask me to do another one. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. Welcome back to the show. I am excited to do this for the next 10 months. I'm bad at math. It's going to be a great year, even if it's not a great year. You know what I mean? We'll do our best to keep up and keep this thing going. So, finally, here is Morgan Parker. Morgan Parker, you are the first person to come on the show in 2020.
Wow.
How do you feel?
Great.
It means a lot more to me than it does to you, probably.
I mean, it's a very interesting tone to set, but
I think it's gonna be a great episode. You're gonna set a high bar for future guests.
Great.
I wanna start with something you said in an interview. You called There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé an archive of the Obama era. How would you describe this book, Magical Negro?
It doesn't correspond to a time period in the way that There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé did. And when I was writing both books, I wasn't thinking about that. It wasn't until after There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé came out at the end of Obama's presidency that I kind of saw how it was really shaped by that particular era and the pop culture involved, and obviously like Beyoncé and Jay-Z sitting with Obama's. This book, I mean, it spans an absurd amount of time into the future and, you know, from the slave ship. So it's not necessarily an archive of a particular era. It's more like the spirit of many eras and how they interact with each other. I thought about this book as a kind of ethnography. That's like the nerd half of me that like studied anthro. And I really thought about it as like making a catalog and you know, the Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, there's a nod that's Let Us Now Praise Famous Magical Negroes. So really this idea of documenting a culture in its own words, like from the inside, kind of a personal ethnography, I guess.
You said the nerd half of you. Are there two parts here?
No, I mean, the nerd is like it's 90%, full.
90%.
I guess.
I didn't mean to call you out on that right away.
You're correct.
Minute three into the interview. Yep. Kind of think full nerd.
About, yeah.
Read your book, read your poetry. Starting 2020 off with an insult. Okay, it's not an insult
it's
at all.
It's not. Come on, yeah. I have a master's degree in poems. I know. There's nothing.
No, I think it's wonderful.
Than that.
But it did start particularly early for you because you grew up and you had a brother who played a lot of sports, and your parents were extremely vigilant about making you try other things in
all
your life. I have a list that includes ballet, gymnastics, soccer, swim team, voice lessons. Someone tried that one on me.
Oh, man.
And you kept saying to them, I hear you, but I'd rather go to the library, even on Saturdays. My parents wish I was that. walk me through you as a kid, knowing that you needed to go to the library and read and write.
Writing is the best way that I can communicate. And I think I learned that really early on that social interactions, like I would come away from it feeling like I didn't exactly articulate myself in the way that I wanted to, or I could see that there was a misunderstanding, or I just really didn't feel like I had verbal language that would fit the playground to describe, you know, like what I'm thinking and how I'm seeing the world. So I've always needed to process thoughts in that way. And a lot of it is just kind of growing up in a really small suburb that was like very just vanilla mayonnaise sandwich. And I mean white, but I also mean just like basic, like everyone is the same.
I do mean white, but also.
But yeah, in addition. So it really was me just kind of thinking, I'm pretty sure there's other stuff out there and I want to know about it.
That's not mayonnaise sandwich.
Exactly. I mean, I think a lot of people, kids go to literature to escape and to explore like other worlds. And I think for me, I've always gone to literature to feel connected and not to enter a new world, but to see my own world in a new way.
Why were your parents against that?
I think it was more just like, we don't believe you, child, that you're like 9 and being like, I will be an author one day. Like, I can't blame them. But also now I'm like, see, you should have just let me go to the library.
Was there ever a point, maybe in high school, where your parents believed you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, after spending a certain amount of years with me, they're kind of like, oh, this kid's up to something else. And maybe we don't understand it, but all we can do is support a thing that she's passionate about. Mm-hmm. Luckily, you know, as I've gotten older, there's like more and more things where they're like, oh, okay, you're like really actually doing something. But I think before it was just a matter of, you know, I grew up and struggled with depression and anxiety. So for them, it was just like, she has this other world where she can express herself and be passionate and excited about things. And I kind of grew up feeling okay with the fact that other people didn't understand.
What did you think they didn't understand?
I do not have like an artist family or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a little bit out of left field for me to only see that the world through that lens. You
right.
know, I'm not interested in like watching the game with everyone else. And I'm really, really committed to exploring the world as an artist. And I think that's like a new thing for folks in my community to understand as like a viable way to move through the world. Even me, you know, I was kind of like making it up as I went along. So I think there's such a premium in small communities like that on just being sociable and popular, and like, I don't mean popular as in like cool kid, but I think I mean it as like palatable.
Agreeable.
Mm-hmm. And I, as much as I, you know, got really, really good at being palatable, I guess, there was always part of me that just like wasn't. It wasn't ever going to be the thing that you're expecting and the kind of attitude you're used to getting mm-hmm. from a person my age.
Well, please don't think you have to be palatable here.
It's over. That whole part of my life is over.
Close the chapter.
I don't think anyone would use that word to describe me.
So far, I say yes.
Okay.
Well, we have 45 more minutes.
It's true.
Yeah. I'm curious because you described where you grew up as the mayonnaise sandwich. How white was it?
Like, we were the only black family on our...
You were?
Yeah, on our cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I was like one of maybe five, six mm-hmm. black kids in my class. And like most of them, I wasn't friends with. We couldn't get BSU together. We like had one meeting and everyone was like, we don't have to do this, right? Like, what's the point? Yeah, it was intense. And my young adult novel is mostly grappling with this, like this idea of figuring out what your identity is when you don't see it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you've spent your whole life trying to find your identity within a very small and white space. And I think that's different than finding yourself. Like finding yourself within the confines of something versus finding yourself in the world is very different.
Now that you're at this place in your life and your career, and especially since you're writing this book, when you're reflecting and looking back at that time, is there a moment or a series of moments that you can pinpoint when you realize, oh, I am not exactly like the people around me?
I mean, I got made fun of in like third grade for wearing a blazer. I remember someone came up to me and was like, are you an attorney? And I was like, what is that word? I think like her parents were getting divorced at the time. So she was like, attorney, new vocab word.
Is that what you said to her? Your parents?
No, I was
divorced?
Just like, what's an attorney? And then I had to like process that.
But that wasn't about race explicitly, was it?
No. But I think I respond to feeling different by refocusing my attention, I guess, if that makes sense. Trying to build my own like safety, whether it's like doing a school newspaper by myself or whatever. Yeah. And I remember a girl pouring sand in my hair in kindergarten, I think, maybe preschool. And I would like get really upset and then be like, my mom said you can't do this anymore. It's such a thing to wash my hair. And she has to do it every day when you're pouring. And the girl kept doing it. And I would like cry and be like, you don't understand. It's like a thing. Like, my mom cannot do this every night. Things like that. A kid asked me if I taste like chocolate. I mean, this is all standard par for
the
course.
What do you say to that, by the way?
No. Do you taste like vanilla? I remember that's what I said. I was like, should we test it out?
I like how the sand problem, you describe it almost as like a logistical scheduling issue where your mother, she's not going to be able to fit that in.
It's just like, I know I'm going to get in trouble for like messing up my hair this way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel bad because I'm like, I can't control it. She pours it. But it is like, it's not just like washing white girl hair. You can't just do it every day before preschool. Yeah, tons of stuff like that. Just little things that I didn't even really pick on until I had a larger group of black friends, you know?
And is that when you went to college in New York?
Yeah, which, duh.
So you double major in anthropology and literature?
Yeah, creative writing.
Creative writing.
I thought I was going to be an English major, but there were too many like requirements of reading like Elizabethan whatever.
Oh, yeah.
No, and I was like, I don't want to read half of this. There was like a whole section of Chaucer that you had to do. And I was like, this is not.
I still haven't. Is that okay?
You're fine.
I feel bad. I mean, I'm not a poet, so I don't feel that bad.
No.
You're a poet.
But.
You don't have to.
No.
No.
I do what I want.
Right.
That's what being a poet is about.
Really? Oh, is that,
I mean, in my mind.
Is that your guiding principle?
Yep, that's my artist statement.
I want to go to this. I'm skipping around, but I think this is actually one of your guiding principles. You said this in an interview back in 2016.
Uh-oh.
I'm sorry. I write out of trying to archive and record my particular experience. It would feel false if I didn't include all those things that really shape contemporary life. I'm not the first person to do that. O'Hara did that. Eliot did that. I don't really see what is so difficult for folks to grasp about it, but I think it's a debate wrapped up in class and race and what constitutes high and low art.
If I said that in 2016, I was thinking a lot about the Beyoncé book and people. I remember people being like, is this poetry? Can you write poetry about Beyoncé? Like, it was this big revelation.
Yeah.
And even when I was in grad school, I turned in some of those poems and poems like about Jay-Z. And my professor was like, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, Pulitzer winner, but like, this is what I'm doing. I tried doing like a regular poem, like I used Bougainvillea or something. I think it's interesting how people get turned off really easily. Mm-hmm. And again, that obviously is wrapped up in the body that I'm in. You know, I had classmates who were playing with pop culture references and they didn't get this, you know, they're like, they look like you, frankly.
Thank you.
So it's a different thing. And of course, like, that's O'Hara's whole thing. And I kind of thought it made sense for me to write in that language because I always want to use my own voice. It doesn't work if I'm trying to like put on poetry voice. And that's one thing that I try to remember in my writing process. But it's interesting how me using my own voice suddenly to certain outside readers means that it's like not poetic.
Mm-hmm.
That's coded language, you know? Like, how is writing about Beyoncé different than writing about some sculpture in the Met? I'm approaching them in the same way. But the fact that people can't wrap their head around one being equal to the other is interesting to me, but troubling, because we understand that artists are here to help us understand the world that we're in. And also, like, Google is around now. So, mm-hmm. like, I feel like I took a class on The Wasteland where we had to have, like, a whole other book to understand the context of The Wasteland. And now people can just, you know, and yet they're like, but what if people don't know who Beyoncé is? That's too bad. Like, huh? Where
well,
have you been?
For them.
Did you just, are you, were you cryogenically frozen? Like, what's up?
Under the rock.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't think that has to be my concern as an artist. That's the other thing that where it's like, I'm being asked to appeal to the masses.
Being asked by who?
I guess critics or a general reader. I think that any kind of pushback I get or folks who say, like, that's not for me or I'm not really into poetry or I don't think this is too jokey or whatever people say, to write it off. People talk a lot about they didn't relate, white people, I mean, talk a lot about how they didn't relate. And
to your writing.
To my writing, which is like, again, a very coded thing, because I do think that I'm speaking to a large audience of people, but I'm also not doing backflips to like take a white person by the hand and tour guide them through my blackness. And you know, I read so much white stuff. I know everything about white people, you know, and I don't understand. Like, I can find myself and my experiences in literature written by white people and about white people. But the fact that that can't be reciprocated is sad to me. But I think often that's what it is. It's like, oh, this, I can't really relate. And it's not, basically, it's not about me. So I can't read it. Or it's not wide enough for me to just like apply to everything, like hotel art or something.
What did you say?
Hotel art.
Is that art in hotels?
I think about bad poetry as like hotel art. It's like inoffensive, but it's like not stimulating.
Well, I think it is offensive.
It's offensive to us. But it's not like...
What does that mean? Are we like elitist now?
Probably.
Okay.
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to sit here and be like, I'm not. But okay. It is a thing that is not... Like, it's not trying to push anyone's buttons.
Mm-hmm.
It's not trying to, like, make any grand statements. It's just, like, there to be kind of pleasant. And I think that's what people expect from poems a lot of the time. That it's like, oh, it sounds really nice. And it's like, interesting. Birds and trees. And that's not what I'm...
Yeah.
I don't give any shits about that.
I'm falling asleep to that one for
sure. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think there has to be some retraining... Since white people are the majority, you know, audience.
Yeah, I would like that.
Because you said growing up and even now, you watch and consume
mm-hmm.
art made by and starring, presenting white people.
Yeah, and I know how to watch it and watch it critically, but also watch it openly and to find value, but also understand the differences in how it was made and how I might make something.
Mm-hmm.
I think also that a big part of it is stepping back from that idea of like majority. And so like this idea of I'm the majority audience, so why am I not understanding this?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, this is not valuable because it's not reflecting the majority audience, which is like white women or whatever. But it's not necessarily my largest audiences. And there you'd be surprised how, because writing and the authors that are getting shine are more writers of color, we're seeing audiences that are larger. And so there's a little bit of needing the white reader to step back a little bit and understand what it's like to enter art from a totally different place and to be not like the expert on things, like to read something and see a language that you don't understand and like you can't write it off from
right.
that.
How do we get to a place where people are curious instead of intimidated?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, for me, it always goes back to empathy. And I think that's what literature in particular is so good at doing, is inspiring empathy. And the more you learn about other people's lives and thought patterns and viewpoints, the more you can understand that you're not the only person in the world and that other people feel. And I think often that's what we forget in order to really consume art openly and also just live as a responsible citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I often find like that's the missing piece, like the inability to see another person as equal. It's really that simple. And I mean that in various ways, like not Civil Rights Act ways, but like, you know, just
hold on.
I mean that too, but like,
you thought I was sitting here and I thought you thought maybe I
no,
thought
no.
civil rights.
No, I didn't think that you thought that. I'm just clarifying. It's just that the minute people hear the word equality, it's like, oh, I get it.
Okay.
But that's not what I'm talking
about.
I'm
just worried now people at home are like, well, I was kind of thinking that.
If they were, then I just clarified.
Thank you for clarifying.
I'm not talking about the Civil Rights Act.
And if you thought that, I love you for listening, but I'm a little concerned. Much respect, but I'm just concerned.
I mean, I think so many of our issues have been latent and they've just gone like untreated, you know? The fact that we are still having trouble approaching literature by the other capital O is just absurd to mm-hmm. me. And I mean, for one, with poetry, I think the whole world needs to change the way that it thinks about poetry. And I think we teach poetry backwards. I hated poetry until like halfway through college, honestly.
Sophomore
and I still am kind of like, I don't like this. You know, I go to readings and I'm like, this is terrible. Why am I making my life this way?
Mm-hmm.
But it's because, you know, I'm thinking that it's Chaucer and like, what's that guy? Longfellow.
Oh, no.
You know what I mean?
No.
And even when we were learning poetry in like high school, the teachers didn't seem, they were kind of like, ugh. Let's get through this
yeah.
to get to the next thing.
They presented it as something that solely existed in the past
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and is a requirement for the curriculum.
Yes. But not helpful in any way to understanding the world.
Yes.
And also, I remember it being really taught as like a puzzle. Like, what does this mean? And it's like a trick question. When I teach now, it's really hard because I'm asking my students what they see and they're like, what's the right answer?
I want to go to something you said. Sophomore year of college, a professor named Josh Bell.
Yes, he's great.
Encouraged you to write. I'm thinking now, you go to these readings. You got here in part because of encouragement from others, mostly because of your hard work. You have labored over the writing weeks, months, sometimes years. I'm interested in what happens at these readings because there is a woman who you did an interview with, and she attended your talk for this book at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Sasha Bonet, I think is her name.
Oh, yeah. That was a fun one.
She described her experience sitting in between two white women. It was like watching Get Out in the theater. She said they were laughing at the wrong bits and looking over at me for approval.
That's hilarious. It's funny. I had the same, and I wrote a little bit about this, the same experience when I was seeing Slave Play by Jeremy O. Harris. And I was like, this is part of the art. And I always think that too. Like, I go to my readings and I'm just like, white women are the enemy. And I'm like looking at white women in the face. And that's like part of consuming the art is like pressing buttons in that way. And the audience experience together is a whole other layer that I'm considering when I'm writing. Because art is not just like what's on the page, but it's like what happens when it's in the world and spoken out loud and heard by a lot of different people at the same time. It is weird. And this book is intense. Like, I can't read it straight through, and I fucking wrote it. So it's a lot, and it's a lot, and it's hard. It's hard, and it's not comfortable, and it's not concerned with making anyone comfortable, not even me. So the readings are just very intense, and I keep being like, I should put more jokes in than have, like, these weird little comedy bits between the poems, because how many times can you just be like, I hate myself? You know, like it's just quite a bit. So I end up performing a lot more with this book. So I read Now More Than Ever, which when I read it, it's a whole thing every single time. Once I laid on the ground, multiple times, I just like leave. Like I went out the doors of the MoMA and was still saying ever and ever and ever. So it is like a very intense experience. And a few of them are like that, where I kind of like freestyle or I will change it up in the live moment. And part of that is making sure that the audience is right there with me. So with Now More Than Ever, I don't know how many. It was in a review. Someone like counted the evers, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I just kept adding them. And so I really adjust the amount of time I spend on each poem. And it's partially because I'm looking at the audience. I see their realization of you know, the content, like understanding intellectually what I'm saying. And then there's a moment of discomfort where they're like, oh, she's still going. And I can see people like nodding their heads like, oh, okay, I get it. It's going on longer. But then there's another couple minutes where then people are just like, what's happening? Can I leave ever? And that's when, you know, you can see the audience of color getting uncomfortable too, but then they're like, oh, yes, yes, I understand. And the white people are kind of like, it's scary. And they don't, to shock people with art is like what it's about. Because then they have to confront why they're uncomfortable. And you can't just hear the poem and say, oh, yeah, I get it. You have to like live inside the poem. And the understanding of it becomes being uncomfortable. I can't accurately make readers feel uncomfortable by just saying how uncomfortable I am. Trust me, I've tried. But the best way to do it is to make them uncomfortable as well. And that's really the hard work as an artist to really manipulate emotions. And that's why it has to do with what's on the page, but also what's in person, which is scary, you know, because I have to be this kind of instigator, you know, when I'm like asking everyone to praise me and like clap. But, you know, you'd be surprised. White women love to like have me yell at them.
They do.
Yeah.
Why,
I feel like they like,
that?
I don't know. It's like they feel like it's rightful or something. They're like, yeah, that makes, you're allowed to say all this and we don't mean it and whatever. I don't know.
Well, I ask because you also said in the same interview that white women really like the Beyoncé book.
Oh my God, they love it. I mean, that book is focuses a lot more on womanhood, period.
Yes.
And like, so they love...
They have a stake in that.
They're like, feminism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they remove the black part in front.
Yeah.
And then feminism becomes white feminism. We all know this has been an issue since the beginning of feminism.
Yeah.
That was really interesting to me. And I was like, oh, of course.
But then you said, when it comes to this book, that you fear they may not come along for the ride.
It's a different response. A lot have. And, you know, obviously, if you're expecting sequins and, yeah, all of that, you're not getting that here. It's a lot of the same concerns, but it's spoken in a different way and dressed up in a different outfit. And a lot of them have responded to that. But I know there's some where it's like, oh, a poetry book about Beyoncé. And then that kind of like wears off and mm-hmm. whatever. So I think that was the fear that I was responding to, this idea of like, I know you, and I was thinking this about all my audiences. Like the last book, it's dark, but it's a lot more fun and it feels a lot more fun to people. And I was like, this is no fun at all. It's just death after death. So there was a fear that, you know, now that I've built an audience, I'm going to alienate them. And that's a hard thing to deal with as an artist, because I want to always be making something new. But every time you're making something new, there's a fear that no one will respond to it.
Putting a pause on the conversation for a second. If you're on your telephone or computer, I want you to do something for me. I want you to Google this. Diana Ross eating a rib in Alabama. If you want to make it easier, you can visit our site at talkeasypod.com and click the Morgan Parker page. On it, you will see an image of Diana Ross eating a rib in Alabama circa 1997. I want you to look at that image. And while you look at it, I want you to enjoy this poem written and performed by Morgan Parker. It is from her book, Magical Negro. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break.
Magical Negro number 217. Diana Ross finishing a rib in Alabama, 1990s. Since I thought I'd be dead by now, everything I do is fucking perfect. Walking, reckless, and men, I suck their bones until they're perfect. I don't sleep with accolades. I don't get touched in the night. All men do is cry and ask me to be their mama. I can't get a decent fuck to save my... When I think about their feelings, I don't care. It's cool, it's cool. Come to mama. There is so much death here. She is casual and almost fragrant, like the word kill doesn't sound as bad as it is. All my friends are sisters and husbands. I'm afraid to be... uncharted. I want an empire in my teeth, but I can't be bothered to wear anything but silk. I have grown up less mysterious than my myth. All men do is think I'm looking at them. When I think about them tasting me, don't Google my tits when you can just, unfortunately, I have a body and I'm the only one in charge of it. You know what? I eat the bones too. I'm in the world. Nobody cares where I came from.
I am thinking about how white women and white men play a role in this book throughout. And in an uncomfortable way. I think I would say I was uncomfortable.
At least your name's not Matt.
That's what I'm going to bring up. How'd you know? You saw my face and you were like, he's going to bring up Matt once, isn't he?
I mean, it's hard not to.
Well, it's also really compelling. I mean, it's one of my, you know, maybe I'm biased, but it's a chapter I'm fascinated by. You have another quote. I'm sorry, I have to do it to you. But you said in an interview, Matt doesn't come to the cookout. There are parts of our lives that necessarily cannot be intertwined. And this hovers over the relationship. I just feel left out of the whole possibility of love and romance. I hate that that is related to my race, and I hate that I believe it. I hate that I have felt it for so long, and I hate that white women have it so easy. Now, that is a quote in response to your piece on here. I forgot what it's called now. It's just called Matt.
Matt, that's what's good. Which is, there was no other time. I thought about it and was like, "Welp."
Matt, or something.
Right. I don't know.
Yeah. So Matt is a stand-in for all the white men you've dated in your life, or have had some romantic entanglement.
Mm-hmm. Situationships. Many of whom were literally named Matt. So
really,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's just a thing.
What do you think it is?
I don't know. I think it's like whatever my age is and what popular names were, I guess. But it's also, or what I was trying to figure out in the poem was like, is it a particular type of guy? Because they were all kind of that particular type of guy. So now Matt is like a slang for that type of guy that's like wearing flannel and like doesn't think of himself as a white man and is like, you know, listens to Modest Mouse, but also Kanye. Like, that is a type. Mm-hmm. Who studied comparative literature. You know, it's a thing. And I wanted to create a shorthand that we do, like, in conversations and, like, in small circles, but to build it out. And I've been so surprised at how much people are like, yep, I know that guy. Or, I am that guy. People come up to me and they're like, I'm Matt. And I'm just like, okay, I just met you, so I have nothing against you. But then they're like, no, but I'm really that guy.
I don't know why someone would do that.
It's amazing to me. It's super fun to like see a poem live in the world and do its own thing. Mm-hmm. So often women are like, oh yeah, this has been sent around our group text. Like, and that's cool to have a poem like take on its own life and for like a Matt to be like in a little slang that folks kind of understand. And
how would you describe, for people who haven't read the poem, the kind of person a Matt is?
Let's see. The first one is, Matt smokes unfiltered Pall Malls because Kurt Vonnegut did.
Yeah.
So that's
that
like...
That was upsetting.
Yeah. That's a true statement.
Not for me personally. I don't smoke, but...
High school Matt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... I think what it is someone that means well, but it's a poem about the limits of meaning well. Mm-hmm. And again, it's about that empathy as well as about standards of beauty and who is allowed to have love and romance and what those relationships look like. I grew up, you know, situationing people like this, but always feeling like, I mean, they're not going to end up with me, you know, like.
Did you know that at the time?
Yes. Because it's like, I'm not going to meet your parents. You know, it's like very, I can't see these worlds colliding. And even the idea of these guys are cool. They like me, but there's no one else black in their friend circle. Things like that. And who their ex is and who's the person they date right after me. Like, what's the thing that doesn't fit in? And it's me. So even though there's a personal connection, there's a cultural divide, and it can't be penetrated unless it's penetrated. It can't be. I'm such an idiot.
I wasn't going to say it.
No.
I didn't even think
I'm so dumb. Anyway, it's something that it will always be unless both parties are like aware of it. And I think the thing about Matt is that he's oblivious, and it's like charming until it's just problematic.
You found it charming.
Sure. Yeah. Or it can be, or you don't recognize how dangerous it is, I think, you know. And the other part that this comes out of is I was like trying to explain to the Matt that I was dating at that time that like I cannot separate our relationship from a master-slave relationship. And that's just like part of being an African-American woman. There's no way I'm not going to think, oh shit, like my ancestors with like a white man on top of them, like the complications of that. And it's not to say that it reflects in the individual relationships that I'm having with these men, but there's no way I won't have one little moment where it's like, whoa, this is weird and fucked up, you know, just in the span of history, because that's how my mind works. Like there's a lot of repetitions and echoes happening on all these like planes of time. And you can't kind of ignore that. And I think that's part of what the poem is trying to say, that you don't have to ignore it. And it's better to just like say it plainly, like this is weird. And it's not necessarily the dynamic of our relationship, but like, yeah, this is the reality of us being together.
Why do you think you kept returning to Matt's in general, knowing all that that you just said?
I think, well, society and like society has told me what is desirable and what is supposed to be desirable for me. So these guys are like, I mean, they're not intimidating. They're nice. Like, there's shared interests, etc. They're not problematic on the surface or even like meaning to be. So the only thing is that they're not confronting their own whiteness, but it's not like they're offending me on the daily or misunderstanding me. Like, generally, they listen. I don't know. I think there's something where you don't really realize how awkward something is until you hit a moment where you have to confront it, if that makes sense.
I can tell that answer doesn't answer it.
It doesn't.
You're not satisfied by that.
I mean, my friends would be like, we don't know. Like, this bitch should just stop with the mats, you know? It's like a soft spot that I have. And I also wanted to like condemn myself a little bit for that. Like, why do I keep going back? And there is a little bit of like, there's yearning, but there's also like disappointment. And they're happening at the same time.
Yearning for
connection and for this kind of light, casual thing. And so there's a way that the poem attempts that and tries to go along with that. And then it's like, oh, nothing can be casual, you know, because America. So that's basically, you know, and it's a fun poem for me because it has jokes and it tries to surprise the reader. And when I was writing it, I didn't know where it was gonna go. I just had been wanting to write about this Matt phenomenon for a while. And I think I must have been thinking about it for a long time, like cataloging all these mats, because when I wrote it, it was like 2 a.m, I remember. And I just like didn't stop. Like I was just like, I'm just going to get out the thoughts and then revisit it later. But I didn't edit it very much. I was like, this is kind of it. And as I was winding to the end, I could feel it happening. But it was surprising me as I was writing it. Mm. Yeah, it was a way of kind of taking a really casual and uncomplicated situation and complicating it. I didn't publish that poem for a really long time because I was like with a Matt. And yeah. Then when it came out, I remember I got all these texts of people being like, am I a Matt? I'm like, okay, Rob, like if you have to ask, my dude, like, but the Matt, that Matt, was like, I love this poem, which was awesome. I was like, of course. Like, he's the only one that's like, yeah, it's a very smart poem. Love it. And also, obviously, that's me.
Think it makes some good points. love the poem. We're going to have to talk later.
Right.
But I think it's the prose so strong.
Yeah.
Really. I'm not going to send it to my parents, but I do like the writing.
Right.
Horrifying.
Yeah, it's a fun one. I remember I was at college once and a student, I mean, this is something that would only ever happen to a woman on like giving a presentation at a college. The guy was like, so are these all different mats you've slept with? I was like, excuse me, undergrad? What in the world? I was like, that's not a question you can ask. At that same college was another kid that was like, so I like Modest Mouse and I'm wearing a flannel right now. And last week in the computer lab, someone called me Matt, but that's not my name. And I was like, do you have a question? What's going on here? But for some reason, it really like jostles something, especially in young men. And so I love to read it at colleges for that reason, because it's also like, hey, girls, here's what to be aware of.
It didn't bother me because I don't like Modest Mouse. I just wanted to say that joke once. I think it touches and eats at white men. One, because it's foreign. Hasn't really happened in modern literature before.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I don't, it doesn't happen very often. It's compelling, not only because it works dramatically, because it's funny. And anytime something's also funny,
yeah,
you're like, oh, fuck, it must be right.
Yeah, it's true. It's also like such a good way of delivering the dramatic stuff,
yeah.
You know, to like also drop in these funny things that you can visually see. Because I know in this book, it's like confront so much and think about so much. But the way often to process that and present that stuff in a way that readers can digest it is also speaking vernacular and using jokes. And that is part of being honest, if that makes sense. There's no way I'm going to be able to deliver like the super painful and honest lines if there's not also this kind of
levity.
Yeah, totally.
You know, throughout this book, and even in some of your past work, there is a streak of loneliness throughout all of this, which just comes with being a writer. In general, you are just, you have to be by yourself, unfortunately. Has that gotten better or worse for you?
Worse, I guess. It gets worse the older I am. You know, it's like, the more you go through
the
world.
First question that you were like, oh.
I know. It hurts. It hurts to say. And I also feel like I'm constantly like in public just being like, can anyone love me? Like, it's just like, I did a recent thing and I was like, I'm single, like at the reading, which is like not a time for me to attract people.
Why not?
Like reading these
poems. Why is it not?
You'd be surprised. It's just not.
It's a public forum.
It is.
You got a mass audience.
It's really not my best foot forward, I don't think.
I didn't say anything about that.
Exactly.
It's not a bad foot forward.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the real thing.
It's an interesting way of soliciting attention.
Yeah.
It could work.
It doesn't work. I'll tell you that.
I'm trying to be hopeful here.
You know, part of that loneliness, and I'm only just understanding this, I've kind of exploring loneliness in my writing, is not just that I need another person here, but there is a kind of existential loneliness of, again, feeling misunderstood or not connecting on a deeper level with folks, or feeling alone in what you see in the world. It can feel a little bit like, are people not recognizing that? You know, like that sort of thing, that loneliness of like, this is the world I'm in, and it seems like everyone else is looking at a different world. And how can we bridge those things and like talk about what we're seeing?
I wonder how it applies and how it informs not just your work, but you living here in Los Angeles now, because you came from New York.
Mm-hmm.
You've been here for a few years.
Yeah.
I felt your loneliness strongest in this one line, which I was trying to find. And everything will be taken away after Adrian Piper. You like it at church when strangers hold your hand. I guess I'm curious how you're managing.
Yeah, I always appreciate it when people are like, are you okay? Like, people forget to ask that. And this is, like, hard work. I have two therapists, not even just one.
Really?
I have three,
not that it's a contest.
I'm impressed.
I'm joking.
No, I mean, I take my pills and I go to therapy. And I was texting a writer friend yesterday about how I spent my whole therapy session this week talking about what I'm writing. And I was like, that's so stupid. Like, I shouldn't be, like, that's my money, you know? But he was like, no, we have to do that. It's part of the writing process and part of making sure you're okay as you're thinking through ideas. And I have a tendency to just, like, go really hard and go deep. And, like, with this book, when I finished it, I was like, I maybe didn't have to cry and bleed so much, you know, to do this. But that is kind of my impulse as an artist. So I have been thinking a lot more about how to protect myself and my own feelings, because that loneliness is still there. Like, it's, you're going through all this. And even when the book is out, the book itself is a product. And in a lot of ways, so am I. So it is something where I need to, yeah, I guess just have, like, a very solid sense of safety for myself, not only as I'm writing, but also as I'm releasing a book. I have a lot of friends who are writers, and we have, you know, lots of little group texts that are mostly just, like, dumb stuff, which is really helpful. What else? Well, now that I live here, I'm just, like, a huge stoner, because I'm just, like, at my house smoking weed with my dog and, like, having crazy ideas. It's like my Joan Didion years, just, like, walking the dog.
This is your Joan Didion years.
This right now.
Is there a part of you that is attracted to being lonely?
Probably.
Do you think it helps your writing?
I don't know about that, but I do think it's something that I'm used to. You know, the older you get, you settle into what you conceptualize as your thing, your way of being in the world. And I think I've just, like, it's comfortable to me to be. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, if I did get in a relationship, someone has to live in my house with me. Like, that sounds terrible. Like, this is my whole situation.
That's usually how it works.
I know. I'm like, that sounds, oh yeah, I never considered that. It is something that I'm used to, like, being alone, moving through the world alone, and having my own kind of space and, like, agency over everything that's happening. All of it is, on one hand, it'd be dope to, like, have someone help me with my various suitcases in the airport, but also I like exploring places alone and just, like, wandering around and, like, eating oysters. That's always what I do in random cities.
Eating oysters.
Just eating oysters at a bar by myself.
I think you probably still eat oysters with someone else.
Probably.
I think it could
work. I have done that before.
Okay.
But it is nice to...
Was it Matt?
To be... I've shared oysters with Matts in my life.
Oh.
Oh, man. Can't wait for the TV movie. I do think that...
I like that you know it's a TV movie.
Without a doubt. It's, like, not... It's not worth anything else. Not Lifetime, but, like...
A notch above.
Like, it could be, like, USA or something.
That's
do they do
one.
Movies? I feel like...
They do now.
Yep. They do my movie. Ugh. Yeah. Obviously, it's part of the artist's mind. Like, we always are going to feel lonely because there's crazy shit happening in our brains, even when we're being social. So there's that, but also just me being used to being by myself and, like, having my own space and all of that. But I also think that loneliness is valuable. I know myself really well, and I have been forced to confront myself almost daily, you know, because I'm having to have the kind of conversations and arguments that I would have with someone else. It is also something that I think a lot about. I think it is possible to be lonely and not to be obsessed with loneliness as a theme in your work. But that is something that I'm generally just very interested in. You know, New York is the loneliest place in the world, even though it was like I had to move because too many people are like, you have to come to this reading. Like, I couldn't get out of it.
You had to move because
across
of
the country. It's too many poetry readings and like galas and shit.
Mom, I'm sorry. I gotta go.
Listen.
This is the seventh reading this week.
It's just a lot. And that's like not an exaggeration, you know? But somehow New York is very lonely, even though it's like people are constantly bumping into you. LA has got its own thing where it's like, my neighborhood is so quiet during the day. And I love it because I'm just like smoking weed and hanging out with the dog and like writing poems. Like, that's perfect. But it is a place where you can kind of like separate yourself. And so I am interested in loneliness that happens in social situations. And I also think that that brand of loneliness is pretty American.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that I'm interested in there.
I wouldn't say you're obsessed with loneliness.
No, I mean, I can't be that.
I think you have other things.
In the same way that I'm like obsessed with slave ships, like, which is not like...
That's not a great segue because I don't have that. You have a poem in here called A Brief History of the Present.
Mm-hmm.
You write, I know it's just a movie, but I'm still afraid of what I see when I fall asleep. I know the masses ask me every day for a eulogy. I know I'm supposed to say shot and killed, say brutality, to call my life a life. This is their language and not mine. When we were talking about the other in literature, I was thinking of examples in modern literature where the mass audience, and that includes white people, in fact, it really includes white people, said, oh, that's good, and that's okay. And the two things I thought of were Citizen and Between the World and Me.
Mm-hmm. That year was, like, really intense.
A hard year.
Yeah. White people were just like, literature by black people.
Yeah. I think Oprah put it on her thing.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and I love both of those books.
Absolutely.
But this, to me, seems connected to those books. I feel in this poem you're describing a kind of writing about a kind of subject, mainly subjects including mass incarceration, police brutality, race and Ferguson or where any of these riots were happening. And I kind of gathered from this, and again, this is why you're here, because I want you to correct me. I kind of gathered that you were like, I don't think so. I don't think that's my lane. And I don't think that's exactly the kind of art I want to put out into the world. And in fact, it seems that most audiences are, by most, I mean white, are really only okay if black people are writing about those explicit subjects and writing about it explicitly, not to knock those two books, which I still think are wonderful.
No. Well, also it's about writing about those things in a particular way.
Right.
And this is very popular in poetry. I never did like slam because I have several anxiety disorders, but it is a thing. Plenty. Okay. Enough.
Sorry, we're going to need a number here. I hate Morgan. I hate to do this.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to those types of readings, you can see that, like, the more painful or, like, the saddest one is, like, the one that people are drawn into. And somehow people are like, oh, that's best. And I think there's an element of, like, trauma porn, you know, in books like that that are, I think this was maybe the year after that year was, like, all the books about slavery, Underground Railroad, and Homecoming and all of, was it Homegoing? Yeah. And I like, I'm still behind on all those books because I was like, I can't read a ton of books about slavery this year.
Homegoing?
Is that what it's called?
By a woman
by
writer.
Yeah, by Yagasi, yeah.
Yeah, Homegoing.
I feel like there are certain kinds of books written by people of color that white people like because it's somehow catered to them in a particular way. I wouldn't say that Ta-Nehisi's book is like that or Claudia's, but there are certain cultural touchstones, you know, like hashtaggy things floating about that people can easily be like, ooh, Black Lives Matter, this. You know, an interesting thing about Citizen is that it was written, I think it was written like before Trayvon. And of course, when it came out, everyone was making these connections to current things. And I've experienced that because like books take a really long time. But when they enter the cultural conversation, they get read through that lens. And I remember talking to Claudia. It was like the first time I met her. And this was kind of like a weirdly bold thing I did. It was like her friend was talking about the book and talking about the catalog of these microaggressions that is central to Citizen. But Claudia was talking about how the first part she wrote was the part about Serena Williams and that kind of section where it's doing something different. It's exploring something about Blackness, but it's not providing these examples that I think that's what was really revelatory to white readers. They were like, oh, this small thing. And, you know, there was an element of teaching versus the subtler parts, I guess. And I remember telling her that that feels like the core of the book to me. And I also think that people will read that part more deeply later. Right now, folks are viewing it through the lens of what is happening right now. Mm-hmm. And Claudia was like, yeah, I like that part. And I do think that it's not that people didn't notice it. It's just that books last forever and they grow with the world around them. So even though books like that are often viewed really like one-sided, you know, or on one layer of understanding, these are books that you can go back to and back to and back to, and it different parts will be illuminated, if that makes sense. And I've done this in the past, this kind of like making sure along the way to explain things and root everyone there. And that's like a step that I decided to skip in this book because I know that that is what people are looking for. And just by being a Black woman, it's like people automatically are like, how are you going to respond to this thing about Black people, you know? And I'm like, I just want to talk about being lonely. You know, like, I think there's something there that all, as far as I know, in terms of my artist friends, we're all kind of feeling that. And I had a friend who had an exhibition recently, and she was like, I just want it to be, like, chains and BDSM and not necessarily like responding to the political era of 2019. You know, we're all just trying to make art. And obviously the world and politics make their way in, but I think often what these white masses are looking for from Black artists is some kind of explanation or guidance or lessons, rather than, you know, just reading a book, if that makes sense. I think, yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, even just when I do readings, I never mention the president. I've never written anything with his name in it because, like, this is my life and I don't want that stain on my career. I talk a lot about the country and about current politics. And even just like on this tour, people would raise their hands and just be like, so what do you think about the election? And I'm like, I never mentioned anything about that. In fact, I've been talking about the country, but through the lens of truly like back in the day. And where did that come from? But it's like you came here to see me speak. And so you just like need something from me, I get like some kind of answer or solution or like expertise. I remember someone was like, what should we do about America? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I'm an artist. Like, we definitely need to do something, but I'm not like here to, I don't have a PhD. Like, I'm not a politician.
America has a lot of problems. Could you fix them?
Yeah. I'm like, I said we need to do something, but you know, it's, there's a way in which a responsibility is placed on you. And it's a matter of like how you deal with that. I'm kind of like, I'm not here for that. And if you listen, you might hear some things that you can take away. But this is not the space for you to just be like, tell me what to do. There's a lot of like, tell me what to do about my whiteness. things like that, that are not necessarily rooted in the text. And I can only have those conversations so many times.
As you continue to write in the new year in 2020, I'm going to continue doing this thing. I am interested, how has this climate and this, I have to say, administration affected your work?
Yeah. Really, it's distracting, you know? Like, I would like to write about other things, but I'm so just, like, inundated. And it's also, there's a, like, I don't know what to say. You know, you were saying, like, there's nothing else I can say. And especially if people are looking to my art, you know, from the expert Black woman, like, how to deal with that, I don't know what I can offer. Like, I'm as question marks around my head as everyone. It's distracting because you feel like it has to be incorporated into your art. I continually remind myself that my current concerns will make their way into the art anyway, but there is a little bit of a pressure that I'm pretty sure all artists are feeling to make this art in the age of, you know? Yeah, just the cultural conversation about that, art in the age of, rather than, you know, art. It's really scary, but more than anything, it's really annoying to me. I literally was texting a friend yesterday. What sucks about this is that artists, it's supposed to be our job to, like, make, at least for me, I look for moments of absurdism that I can shine light on or exaggerate something so that we're learning something. But there's no, you can't exaggerate anything.
No.
It's all SNL all day. So where does that leave me as an artist? I just have to, like, be super serious about stuff. Like, there's not even jokes you can make.
He's taking our job.
It's that just by being idiots, you know, like, oh, it's so annoying.
That's the first time I've heard someone say, you know, it's just kind of annoying.
It's just like, what am I supposed to do now? You know, it's really not fair.
It feels like we have gone like 30 steps backwards.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I don't know if we're going to get back to even where we were. And we weren't
in a good spot anyway.
We weren't in a good spot anyway. Even when Obama left, it was not a good spot.
Mm-mm. It also was like, who am I talking to? It feels like you're kind of talking in circles. And even the idea of audience has changed because the audience is in a different mindset and in a different world and all of that. So it really is kind of complicated as an artist to remain true to, like, your vision. And I guess there's so many things I want to explore in my art that I feel like I can't right now because I'm just too distracted and exhausted by the stuff that feels like it's made up, but is real.
It is terrifyingly real. But in this interview you did with the Paris Review back in 2016, you had this quote I liked. You said, in your work, one of your primary interests is exploring the line between awe and reverence and also exploitation. Where is that line? What does it mean to be at once upheld and at the same time continually made to feel less than?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're talking about your work and you're describing the relationship people have to artists that are not you. But where is that line for you in terms of how you want to be treated?
Mm-hmm.
Like, moving forward, how do you want to be treated?
As a whole person. As my career goes on, I think a lot about how we treat artists, and it's hard because I'm like an extroverted introvert.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I can turn it on. I'm like a Sag, so I can turn it on, but
I know this.
I mean,
I know you've turned it on for this podcast.
Yeah.
And I was trying to convince you this whole time that you didn't have to.
I know, but this is it. This is the on switch. You know.
I know. I'm trying to, like, turn it off.
I know.
I think sometimes you've turned it off.
Yeah, I am a whole person, but I do think there is a way, you know, I was on tour like the whole year, basically. So it's a lot of just, like, stages, standing in front of people and being presenting this product. So I think one big thing I'm trying to point out, and you can find it all over the books, but this idea of taking care of one another and not seeing something on the outside that looks put together and just like moving on. And again, that's that empathy, putting yourself in the mind of another person. You know, I get emails that are like, you must be, oh my God, I can't believe your schedule. You must be, but also, can you do this thing for like $50? You know, and it's like, where, how do we get from A to B? There's a poem in the last book that used to be longer, and it's like what Beyonce wouldn't say on a shrink's couch. And it's,
do you want to read it?
Well, it's like two lines, so I maybe can remember. What if I said I'm tired and they heard wrong, said sing it. And every time I read that, people are like, yeah, amen. And I'm just like, no, but really, like, I'm tired. And it's like, it totally, people missed it. They're like, I know, right? And I'm like, no, but help me. You know, it's things like that, like just focusing on humanity, you know, and focusing on the person rather than the person as a life that matters or doesn't. Yeah, I think we all just need to take care. And it's hard to focus on the individual when we've got these larger political groups and groupings and concerns. But it's really a time, I think, when we need to return to caring for our community members on a very basic human level. So I think that's something that I'm really considering in my art, and I'm considering in my life, as like feeling allowed to ask for that and demand that of, you know, my community.
Well, I thank you for caring enough to come here.
Thank you. It was delightful.
And to sit with me. First show of 2020.
Yeah.
You did great.
Thank you.
Morgan Parker, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And that's our show. Special thanks this week to Morgan Parker for being our first guest of 2020. To read and purchase her work, including There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyonce and Magical Negro, you can visit her personal site at morganparker.com. To learn more about Morgan, you can visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. There you'll find a back catalog of episodes with a bunch of writers I like, including Gloria Steinem, Nathaniel Rich, Shea Serrano, Jelani Cobb, Doreen St. Felix, Jeremy O'Harris, and many, many more. Talk Easy is available to stream on Spotify, Apple Music, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. The best thing you can do to support the show right now is to share it with a friend, to share it on social media. And we are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TalkEasyPod. And so every bit of public support really does help new listeners find the show. As always, this podcast would not be possible without the team that makes it. Our show is executive produced by Janixa Bravo. Our editor is Andre Lin. Illustrations by Krishna Shenoy. Design by Ian Jones. Our music is by Dylan Peck and Jin Sang. Our engineer is Tim Moore. We tape out of York Recording here in Los Angeles, California. Our associate producer is Nikki Spina. And the show is produced by Caroline Reebok. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. And welcome back. I'm excited to do this thing in 2020. It's going to be a big year for the show. And I hope you stick around. I'll see you back here next Sunday with Haley Bennett. Until then, have a good week, everyone.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.